Today is Thursday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko's decision to detain and redirect a commercial plane to apprehend a traveling journalist may be a defining step in the country's future relationship with the rest of Europe.
If now they're no longer resisting that, that means it's going to be that much easier for Russia to have that permanent military presence forward in Belarus, which of course makes things so much more complicated for all of Belarus's NATO neighbors.
We'll have all the details on that story and more next. The parents of the young opposition activist and blogger detained in Minsk after the passenger jet he was on board was forced to land in the Belarusian capital earlier this week are pleading for the international community to help free their son. Roman Protasevich's mother, Natalia, said that she was asking, begging, and pleading for the international community to save her son, because she believed Belarusian authorities would kill him. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg on Tuesday called for an urgent international and independent investigation into the landing of the passenger plane by Belarus and the subsequent arrest of Protasevich.
I strongly condemn the forced landing of a passenger jet on its way from one NATO capital to another. This amounts to state hijacking, and this is absolutely unacceptable. And I think it also it reveals how far the regime in Minsk is willing to go to crack down on democratic forces in its own country. We support the EU sanctions. All the NATO allies are imposing similar sanctions. We call on the immediate release of political prisoners in Belarus, and we will continue to push for an independent international investigation into this outrageous incident.
The United Nations Security Council met behind closed doors on Wednesday, and the ambassador of Estonia, Sven Jurgensen, wrote aloud a statement following the meeting.
Security Council members Norway, the United Kingdom, and the United States strongly condemned the forced landing of a Ryanair flight in Minsk, Belarus, on the 23rd of May 2021, endangering aviation safety, and the detention by Belarusian authorities of journalist Roman Protasevich and Sofia Sapega. We call on the International Civil Aviation Organization to urgently investigate this unprecedented and unacceptable incident and for full accountability for those responsible. We demand the immediate release of Mr. Protasevich, an independent journalist from Belarus, and Ms. Sapega, who were detained by the Belarusian authorities and prevented them from boarding the plane at the Minsk airport to its original destination. We will enhance our efforts, including through the coordination of our sanctions policies, to ensure that the Belarusian authorities bear responsibility for their actions.
Keir Giles is a senior consulting fellow of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Chatham House. He told me that Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko's actions may be a defining step in the country's future relationship with the rest of Europe.
Lukashenko had already effectively turned his back on the West after the August 2020 election by the brutal crackdown on dissent within his own country. But what this latest incident shows is that he cares absolutely nothing for that relationship with Europe and with the West. And instead, he's placed all his bets on Moscow and on that shaky relationship that he has with President Putin. It's a risky strategy, but it looks like, as far as Lukashenko is concerned, that's the way he's going to go, like it or not.
What kind of security concerns does this raise if it is, as you say, that Lukashenko wants to put all of his cards in with Putin?
There are a couple of ways in which this is going to cause serious problems for Europe. Yes, first of all, his demonstrated willingness to actually reach out and touch people in the EU beyond his borders. Now, there was always a debate about how active the Belarusian KGB were outside Belarus itself, but now it's been proved conclusively. Yes, they do follow people around Europe. And here's an internal EU flight between two EU capitals that has been forced down over Belarus. So yes, everybody's going to be nervous about where exactly they're going to reach out into Europe next. But in addition, throwing in his cards with Putin means closer military cooperation. Now, up until now, Belarus had been resisting quite effectively those attempts by Russia to outsource Belarusian security, to take over its defense, to put in air bases, to have permanently stationed troops. If now they're no longer resisting that, that means it's going to be that much easier for Russia to have that permanent military presence forward in Belarus, which of course makes things so much more complicated for all of Belarus's NATO neighbors.
Turning to internal politics, is there anything that you're gleaning from the actions of Lukashenko ordering that Ryanair plane down in Minsk and then detaining Roman Protasevich?
Yes, there are two aspects of why this is so surprising. First, there's the turning his back on Europe and simply not caring about what the international reaction is going to be, so placing a lower value on that relationship with the West than we'd all assumed, but also, apparently, placing a much higher value on this fear of dissent and fear of opposition within his own country. To take such drastic measures against somebody who was not inside the country and was, you might argue, a bit of an ephemeral threat, especially since with this crackdown on dissent inside, it looked as though the internal security forces were actually winning that battle. The opposition didn't look like a serious challenge to Lukashenko, and yet here he is risking his relationships with the rest of the world to arrest one man who he plainly sees as a much bigger threat than we'd assumed.
That was one of Chatham House's Russia experts, Keir Giles, speaking to me from Northamptonshire in Britain. Meanwhile, in Minsk, President Alexander Lukashenko defended his actions and accused the West of waging a hybrid war on the ex-Soviet nation. Following the devastating Gomel volcanic eruption and swarm of earthquakes, residents are urging the government to provide immediate assistance. Now, to understand how the government is responding to the crisis, journalist Anastasis Tudishi spoke with the DRC's Minister of Communications and Government spokesperson, Patrick Muyaya. She began by asking how the government is organizing aid to Goma, a city that already was suffering a surge in violence by militia fighters.
The situation now, the emergency is the humanitarian question. That's why the government sent a huge delegation to work closely with the local authority to make the whole evaluation about first humanitarian level, security, and scientific, because here politicians come in the second level. The first level is the scientist who's monitoring every day the movement around the volcano. And from their input, the government will see what can be the strategy. The first level here, the idea is to see the way we can protect people. And then the government, after the whole evaluation, will see what kind of needs people has now, what can we do, with MONUSCO and other international NGOs who are working in the ground to see the way we can have a quick answer to help those people.
Tudishi then asked how the government will be able to fund the support that's needed in Goma.
You know, it's a natural catastrophe, a situation we didn't prevent. But the government, we have a budget, we have all our difficulties, but we have something always to face those kind of situation. That's why we start already before to send a government delegation yesterday. We started to work with people there in Goma, with the local authority, to give them what they need first to start to intervene. And now we are making this huge evaluation. And then if we don't have enough funds, we're going to call Congolese people. We're going to mobilize them. And then we can see if we can mobilize international community to come closely with us to see the way, they can bring some support to help us to solve those issues.
That was Congo's Minister of Communications and Government spokesperson, Patrick Muyaya. The United Nations says following the eruption, over 20,000 people are homeless and 40 remain missing. The flows of lava have killed at least 31 people and destroyed more than 3,000 homes. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken ended his Middle East tour to bolster the ceasefire arrangement between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip by praising Jordan's King Abdullah's crucial leadership that helped secure the truce.
We're focused right now on responding to, as I said, the urgent needs that exist in Gaza on a humanitarian basis, the urgent needs for rebuilding and reconstruction. And then looking to see actions on the part of both Israelis and Palestinians that will take down tension and try to remove or minimize some of the potential catalysts for a renewed cycle of violence. And building on that, try to, in very practical and material ways, start to improve people's lives and add a real sense of dignity and hope. If that happens, and that will take some time, that may, I think, produce a better environment in which, ultimately, there's a possibility of resuming the effort to achieve a two-state solution, which we continue to believe is the only way to truly assure Israel's future as a Jewish and democratic state, and of course to give the Palestinians the state that they're entitled to.
Blinken said that if things were done right, it would bring relief to the people of Gaza without empowering the militant group Hamas. However, the latest conflict has increased the popularity of Hamas inside the West Bank and may result in Hamas winning the upcoming Palestinian elections. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy asked Ori Neer, the spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, how the U.S. position could impact any prospects of mediating a peace process if both the United States and Israel would not deal with Hamas.
It's a very good question, Mohammed. And, you know, it's a big challenge. What we've seen in recent days, particularly in Jerusalem, at Al-Aqsa Mosque and beyond, is a surging popularity of Hamas in the West Bank. I don't know about Gaza, but in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, it's quite clear. And I think that one of the main keys to try to counter that is to empower the Palestinian Authority and to show that with nonviolence and diplomacy, which have been the imperatives of the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas, you can achieve and perhaps achieve more than you can with the kind of violence that we've seen coming from Hamas. So there are various things that the U.S. administration can push Israel to do in order to empower the Palestinian Authority. And I really hope that will be the case. At the moment, I have to say prospects for that seem pretty grim.
Israeli police launched a wave of arrests targeting Palestinian citizens of Israel who took part in recent protests in support of Palestinians in East Jerusalem and Gaza Strip, while they would not target Jewish settlers who attacked Palestinians and their homes. What do you make of that?
I think it's a very worrisome situation. I do welcome, you know, the arrest of people who participate in illegal activity, obviously, but there has to be an equity between the law enforcement efforts toward Jewish and Arab citizens inside Israel. We haven't seen that kind of equity. In recent days, there have been some arrests, a larger proportion than what we've seen earlier, of Jewish citizens. And I do hope that we'll see that trend continuing. But you are correct. For the time being, the proportion is lopsided toward arresting more Arab citizens.
That was Americans for Peace Now spokesperson Ori Neer speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. The UN Children's Fund is calling for urgent action to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of children in South Asia who are missing out on routine life-saving vaccinations because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein has that story.
South Asia, home to nearly 2 billion people and more than a quarter of the world's children, is buckling under the strain of a deadly spike in coronavirus infections. The UN Children's Fund reports one person dies from COVID-19 every 17 seconds. It warns the sheer scale and speed of this new surge is outstripping the ability of countries to provide life-saving treatment. It says many fragile health systems are at the point of collapse. UNICEF Regional Director for South Asia, Georges Larrivé, says everything must be done to prevent this from happening. Speaking on a video link from Kathmandu in Nepal, he says children and mothers depend upon these care facilities for survival.
During the first wave of COVID last year, an estimated 228,000 children and 11,000 mothers died because of disruptions to essential health services, like routine immunization, like care during childbirth, care during pregnancy, and so on.
He warns child and maternal deaths are likely to be much higher now because the present COVID-19 surge is four times the size of the first. Larrivé says UNICEF has been on the ground working around the clock since the start of the pandemic, but he adds his agency is short of the supplies and the money it needs to carry out its life-saving operation.
UNICEF needs $164 million for urgent delivery of oxygen and testing supplies, for medical equipment, for PPEs, personal protective equipment, and infection prevention and control material.
The UNICEF official blames vaccine inequity for fueling the virus's rampage across the region. He says most high-risk populations remain unvaccinated, and unless the situation is rectified, the virus will continue to spread. He says the international community must not ignore this reality. He says wealthier countries that have excess vaccines should donate these doses to COVAX, the facility that provides vaccines to poorer countries. He warns the longer the virus is allowed to spread unchecked, the greater the risk that more deadly or contagious variants will emerge and circulate around the world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Joe Biden is asking the United States intelligence community to keep pushing for answers on how the COVID-19 pandemic began. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the details.
Dr. Anthony Fauci says he and most other scientists believe the virus most likely occurred naturally.
But no one knows that 100% for sure.
And it's possible the virus emerged from a lab accident, a theory the Biden administration spent months minimizing. The president now says those are the two likely scenarios the intelligence community is considering, and he wants officials to redouble their efforts.
We have to get a better sense of the origin of COVID-19 and also how do we prevent the next pandemic?
White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre says the president wants a report within 90 days. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Myanmar's army has lost a source of revenue as French energy giant Total said on Wednesday that cash payments to a joint venture with the army have been suspended due to the current unrest in the country. Total has come under pressure from pro-democracy activists to stop financing the junta since a military coup in February, which has been followed by a brutal crackdown on dissent. A local monitoring group says that more than 800 people have been killed by the military. Separately, an investigation by the Associated Press finds that Myanmar's junta uses bodies to instill terror. The AP's Charles Deledesma has that part of the story.
An analysis by the Associated Press and the Human Rights Center Investigations Lab at the University of California looked at cases where bodies of those targeted indiscriminately by police and the military are being used as tools of terror in Myanmar. The findings are based on more than 2,000 tweets and online images, in addition to interviews with family members, witness accounts, and local media reports. The research identified more than 130 instances where security forces appear to be using corpses and the bodies of the wounded to create anxiety, uncertainty, and strike fear in the civilian population. I'm Charles Deledesma.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Mali's interim president and prime minister have resigned following their arrest by the military in what amounts to a second coup for the troubled West African country within 9 months. A joint statement that was issued on Tuesday by ECOWAS, the United Nations, the African Union, and other international bodies all called for their immediate release. The Burkina Faso-developed malaria vaccine is not the only solution to the mosquito-borne disease being tested in the country. Scientists in the West African nation have also been breeding genetically modified mosquitoes that may reduce the ability of mosquito populations to actually spread malaria. Henry Wilkins reports on Burkina Faso's cutting-edge research.
The mosquito-borne disease malaria kills more than 400,000 people each year, the vast majority in Africa. Target Malaria, an international group of scientists, is working in Burkina Faso on a genetic solution. Abdoulaye Diabaté is with the West African country's Research Institute for Science and Health, IRSS.
L'objectif de projet Target Malaria, évidemment, est de pouvoir développer un outil de lutte génétique spécifique.
The objective of Target Malaria is to develop a genetic control tool specifically applied to mosquitoes to be able to drastically reduce or eliminate the density of mosquitoes.
Et que ce soit un outil qui soit durable, qui soit efficace et qui soit à moindre coût.
The scientists are genetically modifying mosquitoes so their offspring will be only male, and any females they mate with after release will also produce just males. Since only female mosquitoes spread malaria, the disease should drop off quickly along with their population. In Bana village, where the genetically modified mosquitoes were first tested in 2019, locals were initially worried about the experiment.
At the beginning, people thought that the survey was to release mosquitoes in the village that will give us more diseases. But since we are working together, we do understand exactly what their purpose is. We even help them in their work, like collecting mosquitoes.
GM, genetically modified mosquitoes, are another possible solution to malaria tested in Burkina Faso. The country also pioneered pesticide-infused mosquito nets. Oxford University's Jenner Institute in April announced a malaria vaccine tested in Burkina Faso with a breakthrough 77% efficacy. Target Malaria says climate and environment play a large part in the country's cutting-edge malaria research.
The WHO 2019 World Malaria Report highlights that over 94% of malaria cases and over 94% of malaria deaths took place in the African region. Therefore, when seeking out institutions to partner with, Target Malaria sought out institutions in countries with significant malaria burden and a strong desire to do something about it.
The West African Coordination and Cooperation Organization for the Fight Against Endemic Diseases was set up in the 1960s and headquartered in Burkina Faso. The Research Institute's Diabaté points out that their scientists are the third generation of malaria researchers.
When you grow up in this environment, malaria becomes part of your daily life, and it can make you think it's an inevitability that you have to undergo it. But you go to school, you start to learn, and all of a sudden, your mind opens up, and so you realize what the source of the problem is.
And thanks to their hard work, says Diabaté, Africa's deadly malaria problem is closer to being solved. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Bobo Dioulasso, Burkina Faso.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month in the United States, and during this last year that's been filled with lockdowns, safety measures, as well as precautions, people's lifestyles have changed, and it's also taken a toll on their mental health. Across the globe, people have noticed changes in their own behaviors as well as their thoughts. VOA reporters have met with several Americans roughly a year into the pandemic to discuss some of these changes and how they're coping with them. In this segment of Alone Together, you'll hear from Madeline Arnold, Dave Arnold, Shiyashi Little Dave, Sherry Arnold, Henry Johnson, Angela Connor, Nicole McKinney, and Kevin Mahoney.
Social life is crazy because I want to see my friends. It's really hard to have friends right now. We have to like make sure we FaceTime each other or just like give like a text of like, hey, how have you been? because we haven't talked in like 2 months.
Her life has shrunk so greatly, just basically to her bedroom in the house.
I love books, but I can't sit down and just stay in one spot and just read, you know? So I think there has been trouble, and I've had trouble sleeping, and sometimes I still have trouble sleeping. I tend to be a worrier by nature anyway, so.
The ability to focus has certainly been a challenge.
The biggest thing that it's done is it's made me realize how much social pressure seeing people in person is a really good thing for our health. I've noticed that if I'm not seeing people for 5 days in a row, I am forcing myself to shower, I'm forcing myself to brush my teeth. You know, I am oftentimes forcing myself to change clothes.
Mental health is your ability to manage your emotional, physical, cognitive state of mind. It is being aware of your thoughts, being aware of your emotions, and being aware of your behaviors and how those all intertwine. And your ability to manage that and recognize that sometimes they do go out of whack. Sometimes they are more severe than others, depending upon factors.
So talking through a therapist really helps because they're kind of like removed from the situation. They aren't your family, they aren't your friend. And sometimes it just helps to vent and just say, this really sucks, and I'm going to talk about it for an hour.
The biggest psychological change that I've noticed in myself since the beginning of the pandemic has been loneliness. And I am someone who is hyper social, and it's been really hard not seeing people, not being able to interact with people except through these, you know, electronic devices in our pockets.
Now everybody views everybody else as a source of danger, or something could happen if we get too close. And also the wearing of the mask. You can't read people's emotions, you know, how they feel, or sometimes even recognize the people, because you don't have all those cues.
I was considered essential, and so many people were not, and that was a huge blessing for me. And I use that blessing to help other people through a really hard time, because so many other people were suffering and were, you know, on the verge of losing their homes and their cars.
Things that I've learned since the pandemic was that addiction behaviors as a disease really doesn't go away, even though I've been in remission as soon as I was isolated in my apartment. The way my brain went, here I am 13 years in recovery, and all of a sudden I'm not accountable, except to myself, and people who have less recovery or even less accountable going, there's nobody going to know.
Over the course of time, I learned that there's a rise of domestic violence, especially when people are stuck at home and they're stuck at home with their abusers and they don't necessarily have those outlets and resources. So I created a blog. It's called Ogada Na Isti, and it's Cherokee for We Are Ready. And it's to empower indigenous voices to kind of share story about what it was like surviving domestic violence, just so people have a community and place to share.
The one thing that has grown the most with me is I've grown farther more into my faith. It has definitely allowed me to really dive in and get closer to God, and I'm very thankful for that. And it's hard because, like, you have such a terrible time in the world, but I just truly believe that in all bad things comes good, and you just have to be willing to look for it because it's right there.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, Thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.